Hello, this is episode number 41 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Monday, February 9th, 2009. I'm your host, Adam Thayer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's episode, we're launching a new format called Tech Book Policy Corner, that we will be featuring occasional conversations on in our podcast with authors of important new books about technology policy and the other issues that we frequently discuss on the Technology Liberation Front blog. On this debut episode of Tech Book Corner, I'm pleased to be joined by Professor John Palfrey of Harvard University, who is the co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Along with his Berkman Center colleague, Urs Gasser, Professor Palfrey has recently co-authored a very interesting new book entitled Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives, which was published last summer by Basic Books, and which you can find out more information about at borndigitalbook.com. Professor John Palfrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
John, as I noted in the review of Born Digital that I posted on the Tech Liberation Front blog, I found your book to be an excellent early history of this new generation of so-called digital natives, and I believe it really serves as a starting point for any conversation about how to understand and better interact with this new generation of digital age kids. In fact, I was sufficiently impressed enough with it that I named Born Digital one of my three most important technology policy books of 2008. Now, let me first begin by stepping back and asking you to define who exactly counts as a digital native, then ask you to explain why we should care about this group of individuals and why you wrote a book about them in the first place.
Adam, thank you. And first up, I was very honored to be included on your blog at all, much less to be included one of the three must-read books of the year. That was really fabulous, and thank you for it. I have been very impressed by the public dialogue that has surrounded the release of this book and similar issues, and really grateful for your participation in it. In terms of the term digital natives, it's a slightly uncomfortable term. It's one that we inherited from the public discourse before we started the research, but we thought rather than trying to fight a term that lots of people use, we'd try to reclaim it and to define it in a way that made sense. So Urs Gasser and I, my co-author for this book, Born Digital, we came up with a three-part definition, and part one is that the young people are born after about 1980. We chose this date because that's really the advent of social technologies. We felt like anyone who was born after that date would have been born after bulletin board systems, for instance, had come online, and it was very unlikely that they would remember anything other than the digital world. Secondly, we identified these people as those who have access to digital technology. So you and I both work in an international field. It's crucial to remember that only about 1 billion of the 6.6 billion people on the planet have access to these technologies. So we're talking about those who have access in the first instance. And then third, the thing that we haven't talked as much about in tech policy discussions, although your book on child safety and others make this point, we need to focus on skills that kids have. And the kids who are included in this definition of digital natives are those who do have good skills to use these technologies. And we note that it's not enough just to have been born after a certain date to have, in fact, the access to the technology, but you also need the skills to use it well. And I think that points to a lot of the policy discussions that we should have going forward. So in terms of why we took up this topic and turned it into a book, really for me there are three reasons. And for law professors, there are usually things come in threes, as it turns out. I'm not sure why that's so, but we learned that in law school. Number one is that I'm a dad, a parent of a six-year-old and a three-year-old. And it turns out my friend Urs Gasser likewise has two children of about the same age. And at least in my household, we have a lot of conversation. My wife and I disagree a fair amount about what to do in terms of bringing up our kids in a digital age. And I sort of wanted to do my homework and to do it in public in a way that might, in fact, benefit from other people responding to it. Secondly, wrote this book in part as a teacher. So as I am occasionally in front of a group of students here at Harvard Law School, I look out on a classroom and I don't see lots of students looking up at me. I see lots of students looking into laptops. And it's a very different way to teach today than it was some time ago when, in fact, the Socratic method in the law school meant you were asking someone to stand and state the facts of a case. Now you're putting questions out into a void sometimes where people are paying only half attention to you, and what does this mean in terms of teaching? And then lastly, wrote it as a lawyer and someone who cares, as you do, about internet law and policy. And one of the instincts that I've had in studying internet law has been that it's often not the law in the traditional sense that's going to get a lot of the work done to solve some of these problems. And I think that in looking particularly at issues associated with kids and safety, some of the things you've and I've worked on, the law is helpful as a backstop, but it's not the only thing, and it may not even be the main thing. So in part, we're trying to write a book as lawyers, but recognizing the limits of the law and then saying, so what are the other things that we could be doing that will help kids more than just passing a new law?
Right. Now, in the introduction of the book, you state that the purpose of it is to, quote, separate what we need to worry about from what's not so scary and what we ought to resist from what we ought to embrace. And you also talk about the importance of, quote, balancing caution with encouragement. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to apply that sort of framework or thinking to three specific issues that you discuss in chapters of the book. But first, explain to the listeners why that sort of a balanced view of this new generation is needed to overcome what you regard as some of the fears and overreaction exhibited by older generations regarding this new generation of digital natives.
Well, I really think this is crucial, which is that any approach to any topic that we can take on with data in the first instance is the way to go. And I think when it comes to young people and use of technology, we have a lot of preconceptions and not as much data as we'd like, but there is a fair amount of data. And so what we wanted to do here was to take a look at all the great research that people like Amanda Leonard at the Pew Center have done, the people who've worked on safety like the UNH crew, Dana Boyd, our colleague at the Berkman Center, Mimi Ito on the Digital Youth Project. We wanted to look at all the great research that had been done, do some of our own research, which was we went out and did focus groups and interviews with young people, and then to come back and say, okay, here are the problems, and then here are some solutions that may, in fact, mean that we will get something done to protect kids. So I think first and foremost was to say, let's, in fact, go get the best research and then frame the problems around what we know really are the harms.
Right. Well, let's explore a couple of those issues from the book and a couple of the chapters. I should note that given our limited time here today, we'll only be discussing a few of those, but your book features discussions about a wide range of online issues or concerns related to digital natives. But let's here just look at three particularly important issues that I know will be of interest to our audience: privacy, child safety, and copyright. Let's start with privacy. Your book begins with three very interesting chapters entitled, in order, quote, identities, dossiers, and privacy. These are concepts that, of course, are related in some ways, and you point out in each of these chapters that, quote, never before has so much information about average citizens been available to so many. And yet, of course, part of the reason that's the case with the digital generation is that they are voluntarily sharing more of their personal information and even their intimate secrets with each other than probably any other generation before them. Their lives are an open book or even an open diary, so to speak. John, is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's something to be worried about in the first instance, which is at least to say, okay, this is different. Is it something that we can figure out whether it's going to be a big concern? So I guess I came away from this book more concerned about privacy than I was when I started the process. I've never been a huge kind of privacy zealot. I've always wondered, so what do those people have to hide? And then I realized if we're leading our lives completely over the course of an entire, 70 or 80 or 90 year lifespan mediated by these digital technologies, who knows what the aggregate effect of all of these technologies and all of the data that are put in those through these technologies may be over time. So I guess I have no particular concern about the very acute cases. I'm not somebody who, because Michael Phelps gets embarrassed because he's smoking pot because of a single photograph, can jump up and down and say nobody should use social technologies. It's not that kind of a response. The response really is to say we don't yet know how much in effect in the aggregate all of this activity is going to have on a kid, and therefore we should have an abundance of caution at the front end. And to me, the key thing is really for a conversation between parents and teachers and kids, and then kids amongst themselves saying, okay, let's pause and think before we share information about ourselves and about one another in these social spaces, because, it could turn out to be a tattoo that we want to get rid of a few decades from now, and we're going to have a hard time doing that.
Right. So one of the themes that you develop quite nicely throughout the book, including in the chapters about privacy, is, and tell me if I'm right in thinking this, it seems that you're saying on one hand, look, there is no silver bullet type of solution to many of these concerns, including privacy. But to the extent that there is a solution that probably should be first on the list, it really comes down to education and mentoring and talking to our kids. Is that a fair assessment? And then tell me, how does that apply to privacy?
It's absolutely a fair assessment, and I know this is something that sometimes feels to people like a cop-out to say turn to education as the key answer, but to be honest, I just think it's the best answer and the right answer, even though it's not necessarily a simple answer, as in just pass a law against whatever the behavior is. So one of the things we try to develop in the book is to say there are at least four modes that you can bring. This is borrowed in part, a variant of what Lawrence Lessig wrote in Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, series of different modes you can bring to regulate something or to protect somebody. And the way we looked at it was to say the first line of defense is always the young person themselves. So if a young person changes his or her behavior, that's the best possible thing that we could do. You know, so if it's privacy, it's basically saying, you know, having a better filter for what you put out into the world about yourself. If it's safety, not connecting with that skeevy guy who contacts you in the online chat room. If it's copyright, it's in fact taking responsibility for your actions and so forth. Then we look another ring out and we say, you know, who are these young people listening to? And sometimes it's their peers, to be sure, but sometimes it's their parents or their brothers and sisters. And they learn a ton from our interviews and focus groups. They learn a ton from one another and these people close to them. Teachers, of course, play a key role here. It might be coaches or mentors. Another group one ring out then is the technology companies making these services. And in something like privacy, I really do think that these technology companies ought to step up more than they have to make it easier for kids to do the right thing. One of the solutions that I like in the privacy space would be to say, okay, could the industry work together to come up with a series of icons, for instance, that make very clear to someone when they come to a site, what are they signing up for in privacy terms? We know kids do not read privacy policies. They do not read terms of service, and grown-ups don't either. And we know that we probably trade more convenience for control of personal information. But what if we made the information asymmetry a little bit less? What if we made the information a little bit clearer and more consistent across websites? And then after that, we say, okay, all of that is great, but it may be sometimes the law has to step in here, or law enforcement has to step in the most egregious cases, in cases of fraud, in cases where companies are saying they won't sell your data and then they do, and sort things like that. Of course, you need the government to come in, or you need a private right of action. So we really work from the child out to the people who might affect them and talk to them, to the technology companies, and out to the law as in most cases the last resort.
Good. Now let's turn to the child safety chapter and discussion and hear how you apply that framework there. But before we do so, I want to make mention to our listeners that over the course of the past year, Professor Palfrey has been very ably chairing the Internet Safety Technical Task Force, which was asked to come together and study these issues and report back to our nation's attorneys general late last year. It was my great pleasure to serve on that task force with Professor Palfrey, and I wanted to take the opportunity here to thank him for the amazing job that he did running that show and keeping a lot of cats herded nicely together and producing what I regard as a landmark report on this issue. So, John, thank you for that.
Thank you, Adam, and thank you to the Progress and Freedom Foundation for all of your work on it, too. Very constructive.
It was a great pleasure. Now, John, I've already written extensively about our task force and its findings and its final report on the blogs, but perhaps you could tell our listeners how the task force's findings match up with or don't match up with, as it may be, the findings from Born Digital, and explain why some of the fears out there about online child safety don't necessarily match up with reality.
So my hope is that they're fairly consistent. I think that the research that we did over a few years in focus groups and interviews was consistent with what we saw in the larger scale quantitative studies that we cited in the task force report. But, you know, I think the general approach is very similar. It's to say, let's look very carefully at what the real risks are that kids are running and see if the technologies that we might bring to bear to help these kids match up with those problems. So I think that generally speaking, what we saw was that while sexual predation remains an issue, something we need to be worried about for young people when they're going online, that we need to give them the skills and tools and the support to stay away from those who would do them harm offline, that the trend, in fact, is going in the right direction. There are fewer instances of this over a few decades, and in fact, many of the things we're doing right. That may mean the attorneys general who are doing things right. It may mean schools, teachers, technology companies, and so forth, and that the overall incidence is going down. We need to redouble our efforts, of course, because each one is a horrible case, but that we should also take pride in the extent to which things we're doing are working. We also looked at access to unwanted and potentially harmful content online. And, you know, the data in that case don't show quite the same trajectory in terms of improvement, but they do suggest that young people do find online content that can be harmful to them. Sometimes they're seeking it, sometimes they're not seeking it. That's very much consistent with the findings of our own research in focus groups and interviews. We also found, of course, that the internet makes it more accessible. You can find more of it, but it doesn't have a huge impact in terms of more people accessing it, in fact. So you have to distinguish between can they access it and do they access it. And I think that the suggestion from the data is maybe there's something of an uptick, but it's not a clear case for huge concern. Some people have greater concern than others on this topic. And the third thing that we pointed out in the research section of the task force report is a very large uptick in peer-to-peer harms. Some people call it bullying or cyberbullying. It really touches up against the sexual predation case because, of course, sometimes it is sexual in nature. So we are not positive yet, based on the data, whether or not there's a huge uptick in bullying in the world overall. It may well be that the things that we're seeing the great increase in online are, for the first time, bullying that was happening in the schoolyard now being revealed to people. So it may be that it's all of a sudden something that parents can look in on and see, or teachers. It also may be that because you can see it after the fact, it's recorded online, that there's an uptick. But we do know that there's a lot going on, and that most kids are going to be harmed in some case, or at least run the risk of harm, of kind of psychological harm from bullying and so forth in online environments. So from these three problems, what we did is look at whether technologies, along with the kinds of things like education that you've emphasized in your book on this topic, can have a positive effect. And I think what we found in looking at 40-plus technologies is there's a lot of innovation in the space. There are a number of different approaches being brought to bear, ranging from age verification and identity authentication, biometrics, and so forth, through to text analysis, which is an early stage technology in this area, to the parental controls we're quite familiar with in terms of addressing child safety problems. And I think as a group, we agreed that it wasn't the right time to mandate any particular technology. That's in part because no one of these technologies is going to solve all the issues we were talking about, nor that we wanted to stem the tide here of innovation that we see going on, but that social networks and others online ought to be encouraged to continue to use these technologies, sometimes in combination with one another, and also to work together to keep identifying, and I think this is very important, the best practice for what it is in any given situation that's going to most help kids. So I came out of this work very bullish that technology, when combined with education, law enforcement, and so forth, can help make kids safer over time, and in fact, we're on the right track.
Right. Now, you mentioned cyberbullying and that being probably the greater concern that many of us on the task force are now really trying to focus our attention on, about how to deal with that or remedy that or how to intervene in certain situations. Let me ask you a different question, however, which relates also back to our discussion about privacy and personal information, which is that one of the questions I get a lot from policymakers and average parents alike is the internet and digital technologies changing the nature of how our kids talk about each other, or talk about things in general, or talk about themselves? And I mentioned that your chapter on privacy and identities talks about how kids sort of lead their lives like an open book today. So maybe we have a new baseline, if you will, about how we look at these issues and the way our kids are dealing with them, and maybe what we used to think was very, very private and personal is not so private or personal anymore, or what some would regard in older generation as bullying is, well, just the way sometimes heated exchanges go on a blog, right? So is there a new baseline, or is there something that's seriously cause for concern here?
Well, there certainly is a new baseline to some extent. So I think it is safe to say, as you've posited, I think, in the question, that young people do reveal more about themselves in what are effectively public spaces online. And I think as kids get a little bit older, at least I've seen this in my own focus groups, the more sophisticated kids tend to share less that's risky. And the kids who have just gone online, I think, are experimenting more and share some more risky behavior. So my hope would be that as kids get more sophisticated, yes, they may be sharing more information in public and semi-public places, but hopefully they will get smarter, consistently get smarter, and given the right tools, they can, not to be put at risk through it. But I do think that a culture of disclosure is emerging, and a culture of public disclosure in online spaces in particular. So is it a cause for concern?
Well, I guess one thing that, you know, I'm puzzling over and I don't know the answer to is whether or not it changes, for instance, the reasonable expectation of privacy standard, you know, under the U.S. Constitution and similar laws. If people have come to perceive that they have no expectation of privacy in certain information, does that change the substantive privacy rights that they have? That would be unfortunate if, in fact, what we see is through behavior a rolling back of privacy protections. That's just one example where I think this is something we have to keep our finger on the pulse and make sure that we don't roll back substantive safeguards just because social norms, maybe on a temporary basis, are changing the way in which young people relate to one another and information.
Interesting. Well, finally, let me ask you to address some copyright issues. This is another major section of the book, and you argue in the book that, quote, creativity is the upside of this brave new world of digital media, but the downside is lawbreaking. You continue on and you say the vast majority of digital natives are currently breaking some copyright laws on a regular basis. So that would seem to be a cause for concern for some, and it certainly is today in the question about what we do about piracy online. And you go on in that chapter to say that you would hope that, quote, the goal should be for copyright holders, technologists, and their customers to exchange royalty checks with one another instead of legal complaints. I wholeheartedly agree with that, John, but what happens when some digital natives just simply refuse to play ball by those rules or even pay one penny for copyrighted content, as often happens today? I didn't really see a clear answer to that question in your book, so why don't you explain to me, you know, is there something to be concerned about here, or is there solutions that you can come up with?
So I completely agree that this is a very, very hard problem and that we don't provide all the answers to the copyright crisis in that chapter, no doubt. In my own view, the right way to handle the copyright issue is to move to an alternative compensation system for copyrighted works, particularly music and movies. This is consistent with a book that my colleague Terry Fisher wrote called Promises to Keep. In the sixth chapter of that book, he proposes either a voluntary or a state-run variant of the copyright regime. And basically the idea would be through an ISP, fee paid for ISP access or through your college or university, you would pay something on the order of $5 a month and you would get access to as much music and movies as you could consume and then reuse. And the money would be paid back pro rata to the copyright holders. I've also worked on a for-profit company spin out of Harvard called No Ank Media that would bring this system to bear and develop the technology and is testing it in China and elsewhere. There are lots of similar proposals out there. I think that's the only way to solve this problem on a systemic basis. But coming back to today, under existing copyright law, when I look at the YouTube versus Viacom dispute where, copyright holders are understandably mad at the fact that there are a lot of copyright works of their own on the YouTube site. And I look at, we go on YouTube and click on these sites and see that they're these videos or music and see that they're being enjoyed by lots of people. It just seems to me that the right answer would be we would find a business deal here that basically said millions of people are enjoying the content on these sites and then we should find a way to share the revenue. That's easier said than done, of course, but I think some kind of embrace of how young people in particular are using these technologies rather than consistently fighting it would be a better strategy. That's a point of contention, of course. I'm a fan of sites like Hulu, which the recording industry and the movie industry and TV industry have been embracing, which is a site by the content holders to put appropriately licensed material up there, sometimes with an advertisement and so forth. I think that's a very good approach. I think the iTunes approach is a good one. So I think there is a fair amount of experimentation and business models that will help. But coming all the way back to what about that young person who just simply doesn't want to pay, I think that person is breaking a law, and I think it's absolutely absolutely wrong, and the person should have to pay. I think that the weirdness that we have right now is a culture where young people do know in large measure that downloading music without paying for it is illegal. They also are not that clear on what their rights are in terms of being able to reuse the material, to remix it. So, I look to copyright education in appropriate kind of curricular chunks within schools as being part of the solution here too.
Okay. That compulsory licensing question is a very interesting one. We don't have time to go into it in great detail, but I've spent a lot of time reading and writing about that issue lately, including Professor Lessig's latest book, Remix, reiterates his call for much the same sort of regime. And yet, I guess my simple question is it really that simple? Because my problem is that what Professor Lessig has said in his book and others is that they basically say, okay, look, if we just have an embedded fee for this music, then we can find a way to pay back those artists whose music is being shared online. But there has to be a mechanism to try to figure out who gets what, right? And then the question is, beyond music, is it going to be for movies and television and video games? There's lots of other art forms this could be for. And then what about the free riders or also the people who don't necessarily want any part of this regime because they don't share music or movies or television?
Yeah.
I know these are a lot of questions. We can't unpack all of them here, but perhaps you can maybe take a stab at just a couple of answers there.
Sure. And, you know, I think the most comprehensive treatment, again, is Terry Fisher's book Promises to Keep on this. In the NOANC media context, we've spent a lot of time developing accounting technology that would help to determine on a Nielsen-style basis who gets paid what. So on a pro rata basis, you know, people will get a cut of the revenues. It would never be perfect, of course, just as the Nielsen's or other rating systems are not. But I think we could get very close to that, and a lot of good technical work has gone into it. Derivative works are a particular problem, so trying to figure out if somebody takes a little bit of something, makes something, and then sells that, how do you pay the money back through the stream? There are, you know, again, this is a fairly technical problem, but you're quite right to focus on it as a potential concern. Other concerns people have raised, for instance, are privacy. If you start knowing exactly what each person is enjoying, is there the risk that that information would get out? You know, again, we've got to figure out good technical solutions to it. So there's, you know, unfortunately, as with many of these really complicated issues, there's no fully satisfactory answer. My sense is just on balance, having thought about these different systems, that rather than continuing to have this copyright war, that an alternative compensation system along one of these lines is going to be preferable, though not perfect.
Right. Well, when we have our big podcast showdown about the future of compulsory licensing, we'll have to invite you back, John.
That'd be great. That'd be great. I'll be there.
So, John, as we bring our discussion to a close here today, let me just give you a chance to add a final comment or two, or at least tell listeners where they can find out more information about the book again.
Thank you, Adam. I would absolutely commend readers back to your website and all the things that you're saying and your organization. It's a crucial resource to all of us in the law and policy discussion around technology. So thank you for the chance to be on here as part of that. And in terms of the Born Digital material, the official website for the book is called borndigitalbook.com. There's also an interactive site, digitalnative.org, that has the book in a wiki form and other things where you can have a more interactive experience with it. And we'd encourage everyone to join our Facebook group and so forth and meet us online.
Well, again, John Palfrey's book is entitled Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. I highly recommend you pick up a copy. And John Palfrey, thank you so much for joining us for today's show.
Thanks, Adam. Take care.
And I'd like to remind listeners, if you'd like to comment about something that John or I said on today's show, feel free to do so on the page for this episode of the podcast. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of our show on iTunes. And don't forget to dig this podcast. Until next time, I'm Adam Thier. See you later.